From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rebecca Ward, filling in for Carol Castiel. And today we're talking about some cutting-edge medical technology that is only now coming to the market in the United States. Gene therapy has the potential to cure rare genetic diseases, including possibly some forms of cancer, by introducing new genetic material into a person's DNA to replace the flawed gene causing the disease. Research into gene therapy goes back decades, but the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved the first such treatment only recently for Luxturna, which treats a rare retinal disease that causes blindness. The European Union approved a gene therapy treatment even earlier in 2012 for uniQure's Glybera for patients with a rare enzyme deficiency, but only after treating a single patient, a German woman whose genetic disease kept her from processing fat, uniQure dropped plans to continue marketing the drug in the European Union and decided not to pursue approval in the United States. The reason? The drug costs more than $1 million to administer. So Luxturna, made by Spark Therapeutics, is not quite as expensive, but it still costs hundreds of thousands of dollars. The trade-off for potential patients with this congenital blindness disease, though, can be dramatically improved vision. And despite the hefty price tags, other new gene therapies are expected to come on the market soon, or are currently in research, which also have the potential to cure some of the world's most rare and debilitating diseases, including some forms of leukemia, hemophilia, sickle cell anemia, and immune disorders. So joining me now to talk about the growing medical field of gene therapy is Janet Lambert, the CEO of the Alliance for Regenerative Medicine, an international organization that focuses on advanced therapies and advocates for the continued investment, research and development, and successful commercialization of safe, effective treatments. Also joining me today is my colleague Rick Panaleo, who is the host of PCUSA Science Edition. Thank you both for joining the program.
Thank you.
And then I just
nice to be with you.
Thank you. Well, first, I want to start about talking about some of the new generation of gene therapies, cures for rare genetic diseases. I mentioned two of them, but what are some of the other ones that are at work right now?
There's a whole variety of therapies in the pipeline. One of the things that the Alliance for Regenerative Medicine does is it tracks products in clinical development. We're now keeping track of more than 1,000 clinical trials, and over half of those are for gene therapies and gene-modified cell therapies. So the pipeline is very, very full. Some of the near-term products that we're anticipating treat diseases that range from additional ophthalmological conditions to CNS and neurological diseases like Parkinson's, as well as various musculoskeletal conditions.
Janet, I'm going to step back a little bit, if you don't mind. I'd like to know how gene therapy works and how is it administered to patients?
Good question. So there's different kinds of gene therapy. Gene therapy can be administered in vivo, inside the body, or ex vivo, outside the body. As you may know, gene therapy can either be about silencing a gene that's not working and causing a disease of some sort, or it can be about editing or replacing a gene that is defective inside an individual. So those different techniques come along with different technologies, and there's a whole variety of approaches to gene therapy.
Is gene therapy considered to be a cure or that, a therapy or a treatment?
Gene therapy, one of the things that makes gene therapy so exciting is the prospect of taking a monogenetic disease, in particular, a disease caused by one faulty gene, and fixing that gene and thereby curing that patient. That's what has so many patients and clinicians really excited about gene therapy. That said, there are other approaches and conditions where whether the treatment is curative or simply durable isn't quite known. So, for example, in gene-modified cell therapy, there's been a lot of activity in that space now. You extract the T cells from a patient and genetically engineer them so that they are particularly assertive in going after the cancer inside your body. That has shown remarkable results to date. It's not clear whether that will be a one-time treatment or not.
That brings me to my final question here is, we're talking about gene therapy, but as you mentioned, cell therapy, are they the same? Or if so, if not, what are the differences?
They're related. So gene therapy is, as I mentioned, is about kind of fixing a gene inside the body. Gene-modified cell therapy is a process whereby you use the cell to deliver, you make a genetic modification in a cell and reinsert that in the body. So that may have a long-lasting change in the body, or it may be that you're just engineering that cell in a way that it, as I said, attacks the cancer inside the body.
And Luxturna would be an example of that, where they actually injected into the eye a virus that corrected with a gene that was correcting the problem.
So Luxturna is a gene therapy in the first category, not the second category.
Okay.
So there you actually made a change in the genes inside the eye.
For a
permanent change. That's right. You didn't extract cells, change them, and reinsert them.
And what I understand about Luxturna is that the disease, that it causes a nerve damage, like degenerative nerve damage. So with younger children, it will work much better than if the nerve damage has already been done and cannot necessarily reverse. So the idea might be to be able to correct the gene before it causes more damage?
You know, I'm not that familiar with that particular case, but that what happens sometimes when you have a faulty gene is that it sets off a faulty cascade, right? So the gene either doesn't produce a protein it's supposed to produce or produces too much of a protein it's not supposed to produce. So it is the case that it could be that untreated, the condition gets worse and worse and worse. And therefore, as soon as you can correct that genetic mutation or that genetic flaw, the better off the patient will be.
And let me get just back to what I was talking about earlier in my introduction was about the money involved. So I imagine there's a great deal of money needed to advance this kind of research, not just the number of researchers and the trials, but there's a lot of government paperwork you have to go through in order to get to a point where you can finally test it in patients. So where's the financing for something like this come from? I mean, some of the pharmaceutical companies I was reading about, I had not heard of because they weren't Briggs Myers or Bayer. There were some names that I had not heard before, but they're probably quite large. I just am not that familiar with them.
Yeah. So the financing for this space has come from a number of sources. You know, the innovation in biotechnology tends to start in universities and research centers around the world. And those research centers tend to get funded by the NIH, for example. So that's sort of the starting seed corn, if you will. But now that there's been so much clinical success, either in clinical trials or in the market, there's a lot of attractiveness for these projects in the commercial world. And so we've seen in the last year a remarkable growth in investment in gene therapy companies, either by investment funds or by large pharmaceutical companies of the type you were talking about. So Pfizer, for example, is very invested in gene therapy. Novartis is a company that's very active in this space. And there are other large companies that have either developed programs internally or they're finding little biotech companies of the sort you might not have heard of and establishing some sort of partnership with them.
And that's kind of what happened with Spark Therapeutics. What I read is that it was actually started out of a research facility for a university, and then they decided to go public, as it were, not public in the sense of Wall Street, but form their own little company. And now they're, working with larger research facilities in order to facilitate more gene therapies.
There's a lot of this kind of work going on in the Philadelphia area, in part because the University of Pennsylvania is one of the leading academic centers. And to your point, either companies spin out or folks come from elsewhere and try to establish some sort of collaboration with the University of Pennsylvania. That's not the only example, but it's a prominent example.
I want to talk about money, too. What are the costs of gene therapy? I understand it's very expensive.
So, you know, there are a limited number of gene therapies on the market now, so I don't think we really know what the cost of gene therapy writ large will be. And the cost will vary, one of the challenges that companies in this space have is that many of the diseases that are potentially the greatest beneficiaries of gene therapy are rare diseases, are orphan diseases, where there's maybe 20 patients a year, for example. And that obviously creates a challenge when it costs a lot to develop a product and put it through clinical trials, and then there's only 20 patients that can benefit. Those therapies might well be pretty expensive. Then you have therapies which might be for a disease that has a larger patient population. One of the most exciting areas of promise is in hemophilia. Hemophilia is a disease that seems like it would respond very well to gene therapy. There are, you know, hemophilia is not a widespread disease, but neither is it a rare disease. It's also a disease that is very expensive now. To not cure hemophilia is very expensive, both for the patient in terms of wear and tear on them, as well as their out-of-pocket costs, and for the healthcare system. So it's been estimated, for example, that a hemophilia patient costs just to keep them healthy is something like $200,000 to $300,000 a year. So even in that example, if you can cure hemophilia, even if it costs $1 million, everybody might be better off at the end of the day. So I think we will see over time, as competition enters the market and there are more products in this market, kind of how the costs pan out. But I think what's unique about these therapies, right, what really makes the reason people are so excited about gene therapy is, one, that there is this potential to really cure a disease, not to just treat a disease as best we can over a long period of time, and that that could happen in a single administration. So you could have one time that you go and get a therapy administered and that it lasts for the rest of your life. So it's likely to be expensive because all of the cost is layered into kind of that one event, as opposed to, you know, a lifetime of taking a pill or going for treatment or therapy.
The reason why I ask the question is because of every form of pharmaceutical or gene therapy needs to be refined, or if there's a problem that pops up, needs to be rectified. And if therapies are so expensive that people who aren't very rich can't afford the gene therapy, how has that worked out? I mean, are there programs?
Pharmaceutical companies tend to run patient assistance programs where they provide support to patients who need a therapy and can't afford it. What we're doing as an organization on a kind of systemic level is to try to enable some new kinds of what we call novel payment mechanisms, right? So we're trying to build an insurance infrastructure that will work for insurance companies, for providers, and for patients, right? Understanding what's really valuable about these therapies, but what also might be pretty expensive about them. So part of what those new payment models include are things like what we call pay per performance, meaning companies are willing to enter into agreements with either Medicare, for example, in the federal government side, or with a private payer and say, Rick, if you get this treatment and it cures you, the price is X. If it doesn't work for you, the price is Y. You know, so that there's risk, the company is willing to take on some of the risk of your what might be a varied patient response. And it's in those through those mechanisms that we're trying to build on the current infrastructure so that patients can have access to these therapies. Because as you've said, you know, the point of developing them is not to have a really exciting science project. You know, it's to sort of change the world by making people healthier.
I'm going to get back to that in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Did you know PCUSA is available for free download on iTunes? You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. And here's a shout out to Raja Bhavni, a listener and Facebook fan in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. Thank you for listening, Raja. We would love to hear from some of our other guests, so please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Carol Castiel VOA or on our webpage at voanews.com/PCUSA. Now back to our program on the promise and price tag of gene therapy. Our guest is Janet Lambert, the CEO of the Alliance for Regenerative Medicine, an international organization that works with its members and policymakers to foster investment, research and development, and successful commercialization of safe and effective therapies for patients around the world. My colleague Rick Panaleo also joins me in the studio. He's the host of PCUSA's Science Edition podcast, and I'm Rebecca Ward, filling in for Carol Castiel. So I want to get back to the idea of money. I'm curious, Glybera was one of the programs that I mentioned earlier, a treatment that I mentioned earlier, and they decided not to pursue the marketing of their drug because it could only affect maybe 700 people in Europe. So why would a research team even begin to go after such a small number of patients when there are so many other diseases that affect millions and millions of people around the world? I mean, there wouldn't be much of a financial payback or even more of a dent in the human scheme of things.
Couple thoughts about that. Companies go after these rare diseases in many cases because they really think they can tackle them, right? You know, sometimes it's just that the opportunity is there to really make a difference. And you're right that if you think about it in a macro level, treating some of these rare diseases doesn't make a dent in the human condition. But I'll tell you, having interacted with some of the patients and families of kids in particular with these rare diseases, it's incredible. You know, you are really personally motivated to help them. We had a discussion. There's a rare disease called epidermolysis bullosa, which is a disease in which essentially kids' skin doesn't stick to them. Their skin sort of peels off in layers and layers all day, every day. So families spend hours a day bandaging kids, unbandaging kids. You know, kids are sort of basically in a condition of having widespread sore. I mean, it's just awful. The whole disease is just excruciating to even see pictures of. So I think there are examples of these rare diseases where one is so moved to want to help those who are affected that it's a powerful motivation. As I said, in many cases, these rare diseases are genetically based, so it's an opportunity to see what works. And there's also often a community built around these rare diseases that has created a registry or a natural disease study or some of the other things that are necessary to conduct an effective clinical trial so that it's possible. But you're right, it's not necessarily a good business. And we have seen examples, as particularly in Europe, where products have come to market and not succeeded or certainly not been profitable. So I think at this phase, many companies are sort of in a proof of concept phase, if you will. They want to demonstrate that it can be done. There are some special opportunities to do research and bring products to market in the orphan drug stage. And I think that they do have their sights on more widespread indications, but the rare disease community is compelling in its own ways.
Generally speaking, how long does it take to develop, test, and finally release a final market-ready gene therapy product?
You know, I would say that there's nothing particularly different about the time it takes to develop a gene therapy product than other kinds of drugs and therapies. And I'm not an expert on this, but I think the current estimate is about 8 to 10 years.
I wanted to ask you, going back to the price tag associated with some of these gene therapies in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, I understand that all the money it takes to go into the research and, mm-hmm. and development phase of this is, it could be, you know, astronomical. But how do you, from a marketing perspective, and also just from how do you counter the backlash against some of these therapies, you know, the picture you paint of the child suffering from a horrible skin disease, and then on top of that, it could be in the, again, hundreds of thousands, more than $1 million to treat such a case.
Yeah, I think it's a challenge that we'll continue to face. As I said, I think we all are, we respect the concerns that patients and insurers and policymakers have about the price of these therapies. Right now, we're trying to build a system in which there is enough reward that it's worth the investment over these many years, as we talked about, and that it makes sense to treat, to pursue cures for even a small population. So I think we've done some the Alliance for Regenerative Medicine has an affiliated foundation that does some public education and survey work. And it's interesting, the initial work that they've done is about trying to understand what people know about gene therapy. What do they have concerns about gene therapy? You know, what's their general attitude about it? And I think, you know, a number of concerns come up in those initial conversations. And what tends to change people's thinking is just to understand that at the end of the day, you know, your health is the main thing that matters. And people are interested in these therapies being as affordable as possible. But the first order of business is really figuring out how to cure some of these terrible diseases.
How do you know if a patient is an appropriate candidate for gene therapy? Are there testing procedures? I mean, gene therapy may work with patient A, but not work with patient B. How do you tell?
Right. It usually has to do with the basis of the disease, right? If the disease has a genetic cause, then that patient would likely be a good candidate for gene therapy.
So we're talking about diseases like cystic fibrosis.
Sickle cell, Huntington's disease, right.
That would be a huge advance. Huntington's disease, it's such a, is that one of the therapies they're working on right now?
You know, there's not a Huntington's disease therapy in late stage clinical trials, but it's a genetically based disease. Therefore, it would be a likely target.
So presumably once they kind of get the pattern down, you could use gene therapy for nearly, you know, almost anything, just kind of mimicking the same kind of pattern, just changing whatever virus you use to introduce the gene into this body, you know.
And the gene itself. That's right. Now, so if you think about, you know, if you talk to the rare disease community, there's like 7,000 rare diseases. 80% of those are monogenetic, genetically based diseases.
So one gene.
Addressed, right? So, and of those 7,000 rare diseases, a couple of hundred have a treatment, right? So you've got this wide open universe of conditions that are prime candidates. As you say, once sort of the proof of concept is demonstrated and we get a little bit more experience, that's why people are so excited.
Once a patient is undergoing gene therapy, how long does it take until doctors know if it's working or not?
It's usually fairly rapid, right? Because once the corrected gene is introduced, it generally starts working right away. So I don't know the data in the Luxturna case, which would be the best recent example, but it's a very short amount of time.
I just want to make sure that we don't make this sound like it's just all sunshine and lollipops, because there are some, I presume, some dangers associated with gene therapy, because early on in the testing there was, I don't know the particulars, but a young teen died from, he was part of a test. Mm-hmm. So what would be some of the dangers or some of the effects, the negative effects of gene therapy for some people?
Yeah, I mean, in any, you know, any kind of medical research or new medical treatment, there's always the risk that you know, there'll be a negative event, a patient who will suffer in some fashion. I think that there have been lessons learned in the past. You're right; there was this sort of famous case a number of years ago that really really chilled the whole gene therapy space for more than a decade. In the case of CAR T therapies, one of the things companies are very focused on, and these CAR T therapies are the ones I described, where you extract cells, you make a genetic modification in the cell and reinsert them into the body where they multiply and go after cancers. In that case, there's something called cytokine release, which is a which is a reaction that some patients have, which can be fatal if not fully understood and monitored. But it is understood that that is the risk right now. So now companies involved in the CAR T space are very focused on this. It's also one of the reasons that right now, most of these gene therapies are administered only in centers of excellence, you know, where the staff is very well trained in these therapies. The company works very closely with them. Often it's members of the academic team that have developed these therapies in the first place. So right now it's a fairly small set of places where you can get gene therapy for the most part, because you want to have all that expertise around for these first products.
How long do you think we'll have to wait until gene therapy is very common and can be accessed from sites all over the world?
I think gene therapy will be common in the next 5 years. The FDA has estimated that they anticipate they may see dozens of gene therapies in the next few years coming to their door for approval. So I think once there are two dozen gene therapies in the market, I would call that common.
There are hundreds of perhaps thousands of different types of leukemias. But I do remember a story about one, and it's a very similar to gene therapy, and perhaps it was. But again, introducing good cells to go after the bad cells. So that would be certainly something that would be extremely welcome. But I assume right now it's worked for some. It hasn't worked for everybody. But childhood leukemia is really a devastating disease for the family, for the child, of course. What do you know about what's in the works for?
Yeah. So two of the first, there's a sort of a nomenclature issue. Some people call these cell therapies. The FDA calls them gene therapies. We call them gene modified cell therapies. Two of these first products, the first two ever approved in the United States, were approved within the last 15 months. One is called Yescarta. The first was called Kymriah. Both of them have the indication that they're interested in is leukemias.
And they're in clinical trial now?
They actually have been approved and they're in the market now. They're the first two products that have made it to market. We have found, right, that these gene-modified cell therapies are particularly effective in blood cancers. So there are a number of products in development that target various kinds of leukemia, childhood and adult. Part of the holy grail of this space is whether these therapies will also be good for solid tumors, right? Because obviously that's a disease that affects lots and lots of people.
I know when we were first discussing genetics in medicine a few years ago, one of the highlights was personalized medicine. Are there possibilities of personalized gene therapy tailored to specific individuals?
Absolutely. In fact, in the gene-modified cell therapy world, people talk about allogeneic and autologous cell therapy. Autologous cell therapy is cell therapy that uses cells from your own body. Mm-hmm. So it absolutely is personalized. And it creates that very fact that the drug is essentially drawn from you and unique to you is part of what we think makes it especially effective, but also creates some challenges for regulators and others. But it is highly, highly personalized. There's a lot of work going on to see if certain cells, this allogeneic idea is, can we create an off-the-shelf cell that has application for any of these indications that we've talked about? But right now, most of the work is done in this personalized fashion using your own cells.
We're going to have to wrap it up in just a moment, but just some final thoughts about gene therapy and its promise for the future.
I would say gene therapy is on fire at the moment in every possible way. Scientifically, we're seeing incredible scientific results in gene therapy. And because of that, now I mentioned earlier, we track regenerative medicine around the world globally. Now, more than half of the clinical trials we're tracking are in gene therapy. Gene therapy holds incredible promise for all kinds of people around the world. And the amount of kind of effort and investment going into this space is extraordinary. And that should translate into a wide variety of products reaching patients soon.
And hopefully lower prices.
hopefully,
to reach all those patients.
Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, we have to end it there. Very exciting discussion. Thanks to Janet Lambert, the CEO of the Alliance for Regenerative Medicine. Thanks also to my co-host, Rick Pantaleo, who is also the host of Science Edition Press Conference USA. And I'm Rebecca Ward, filling in for Carol Castiel. Tune in again next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.